Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I'll just say this right off the bat, right as we get started here. If you're one of those people who only enjoys the extremely serious and hyper-focused, theme-based, atheism-based shows that we do, if those are the only ones that you enjoy, I'll see you next week. All right, I'll see you next week. Nothing personal, no problem. Next Tuesday's broadcast is going to be a great one. It's an audio and video of a discussion with author David McAfee. He's got 4 books out, just finished a 5th that comes out next spring. But the most recent one that's available now is the one that most intrigued me. It's called The Book of Gods, and it's a children's book. It's kind of a comparative book showing all these different deities in a way where the kids start to look at these myths that are posited by different religious cultures and faiths and religions. And it's a chance for them to see these gods side by side by side in kind of a fun way to spur their imagination and to promote critical thinking. I thought, this is a project I think that has merit. Let's talk to David. He's my guest on Tuesday. Going to be great. Tonight is just whatever spills out of my brain. And a lot of the stuff I'm thinking about, quite frankly, has nothing to do with atheism or little to do with atheism. It's just about stuff. This is a diversion, a distraction, something entertaining to listen to. We didn't have anything else on the schedule. I had not scheduled a broadcast, was going to take the week off, but at the last second decided, hey, let's just see what happens. So it's the ranting of your host and a few random phone calls. We'll just see what happens next. Okay? We just recently jumped on the Pokemon Go train. Now, don't say it. Just hear me out. If you're, you know, in a cave and you don't know what I'm talking about, all right, Pokemon Go is this app for smartphones. It's a game where you use a literal map of your neighborhood or city or what have you. It's a global map, as I understand it. You can go pretty much anywhere, I think. And as you are walking, it tracks you like a GPS. And these Pokemon, little pocket monsters, they're not monsters, they're cute little cartoon characters, will appear. And then you capture them. And it's really pretty clever stuff. We hadn't played. We weren't really all that interested. But Hannah came back and was talking about some of her friends playing. So my wife said, hey, what's this all about? And she downloaded it to her phone and they started to play. It's about 9 o'clock at night. Before I know it, we're all walking around our house, inside the house. And on her screen, perched in my office, is her very first Pokemon. And she screams with delight, and they capture the Pokemon, and they get points or something, and now they're hooked. Within the next hour, we were all in my car, driving the neighborhood. All right, the sun is long gone down. Everybody has to get up for work the next morning. Doesn't make any difference. We're all driving around, waiting for these pocket monsters to appear on the cell phone, which I had up in my little GPS, my little phone holder on the dash. I'm the driver. My job was to keep my eyes on the road, to keep my family out of danger, because they had checked out. They were so immersed in what was happening on the screen that a T-Rex could have walked in front of my car and they would not have seen it until it was too late. So I was the safety mechanism in this scenario. All right, I'll do the driving. You find your little monsters. And we were driving around. We end up in somebody else's neighborhood next door. They see something and pop out of the car, and they're running to go chase it. And it's this surreal thing. It's actually really ingenious. As they run, they're walking down, and on the phone, at a specific geographic point, this little character appears, and then you do this game to capture it. As this happens, there's a guy in a two-story house next door who says, "Hey," out the window. I'm thinking he's pissed because we're traipsing around his neighborhood after dark. He comes down the stairs and walks out the front door, and he says, "Hey, what'd you catch?" He has his phone. He's been playing Pokemon Go. 20 minutes later, we are downtown. We are driving around looking for Pokemon. We pull into this one little, I don't know what they call them, these little hubs or landmarks, or they're places where you can get stuff. I don't know. Look, I wasn't playing. I was driving. There must have been a dozen people. They're all sitting at this one spot. I guess the Pokemon appear at specific points, and you just see folks rush to that area to go get it. Tons of people just sitting there, and they all had their phones up, and they were playing the game. As I was driving back, I found myself thinking about it. I was thinking, how do I feel about this? And this new frontier. Is this a game that could only exist in the 21st century, right? I'm not one of those guys who's like, "Oh, technology is ruining us all. We're all disconnecting." I mean, there's a measure of that. Again, when you only speak in extremes, you'll start to talk like that. But I honestly see the smartphone as having connected me in many ways to the world. I mean, I'm able to do so much. I have more computing power in my pocket than NASA used to put astronauts on the moon back in the 1960s. I'm well aware of the benefits it has brought to my life, and all things do ye in moderation, and I understand there's a dark side to technology. I get all that. I get it. But I look at Pokemon and I think, well, you know, for my family, it became a social exercise. It was something we did together. We packed in the car. We're all laughing and carrying on, and we're telling the stories. We're having a good time. We created a memory together. And I thought, well, you know, that has merit. That's, for us, was something that we enjoyed doing together as a family. It's something we were able to talk about and laugh about the next day over dinner, that kind of thing. But I also saw some people who were just by themselves. I mean, it was at night downtown. They're walking down the sidewalk with a phone, looking down, not around, looking only at the phone. And as they walk, I'm making up a biography about them. I'm thinking, who is this person? Why are they out by themselves at this time of night? Are they just getting out to stretch their legs? Are they going for a walk and this is something they do to distract themselves? Good for them. Or are they someone who is disconnected from flesh and blood human beings in their own life, and they occupy their mind in isolation by immersing themselves in this virtual world? I was at Best Buy the other day, and I walked by a display they had for PlayStation 4, and they had this virtual reality set up for something that's coming out in a few months, I guess. Had the chair set up, and they had the headphones and the VR helmet that you put on, this visor that covers your whole face. And so I was game. I said, well, let me try it. And they sat me down in this kind of throne, and they gave me a controller. And they put the VR, the virtual reality visor on me, and it fit really, really well. I always thought those things would be cumbersome and uncomfortable, and it was really cozy. Like, hey, I could spend hours in this thing. They put these headphones on me, the closed-ear headphones that block out the rest of the world. And then they have me select my game. And as I look down through the I'm looking through the visor, I see not the real world, but in the visor, as I hold the controller, I see an emulation of the controller in my hand floating in space. I don't see my hands. I can see the controller or an emulation of it. So I'm clicking the buttons, but I don't see my thumb on the buttons. Now I'm weird. It's weird. Pick a game. Oh, they have Battle Zone, a game I grew up on, which has evolved over the decades. I click it, and before I know it, I am immersed. I'm immersed in another world. I'm surrounded by sound in all directions. I am looking in, I think my field of vision must have been 270 degrees. I mean, I'm looking all around. I'm looking at this world that I have immersed myself in. And I'm on this elevator, this platform, as I'm going up toward a practice area where enemy targets come out and you can work on your skills and all these things are happening. And I was reminded of a conversation I'd had recently with a friend about the virtual world. When the technology allows us to enter a world that in some way rivals or even exceeds the real world for us in some way, it scratches an itch that you don't get in the real world. What happens to society? What happens when we can check out of the everyday problems and challenges and ups and downs, you know, the roller coaster of the real world? What happens when you check out of that and you can escape over here in a place that is designed, you know, it's designed to be a specific thing that you crave or that feeds you in some way? Does it become like a drug? And before you know it, you begin to ignore the things and the people in the real world. Do you stop connecting with flesh and blood people because you are so busy interacting with virtual ones? Are you calling into work? Are you neglecting your children? Are you pausing all the projects in your real life, in the real world that you were working on, that you were focused on, that you were attending to? Do all those things just come crashing to a halt because it's so much more awesome to put on the helmet and put on the headphones and escape? Of course, I am far from the first to have asked this question. Hell, there are whole books and films and a lot of creative resources that delve into the consequences of our own advances for good and for ill. And I always come back to all things do ye in moderation. You know, I love the idea of being able to jump into a virtual game world and do amazing stuff. I think there are things that they're going to be doing in a few years we can't even imagine yet. And I'm not threatened by it. I'm not freaked out by it. But I do understand that, you know, after watching people who are, I don't know, they just seem locked off all of a sudden from reality, I do see there's going to be a culture of people that check out. Technology gives them a door, an escape hatch that they use to try to get away from all the shitty stuff that they've been dealing with, or maybe even an excuse to check out of the responsibilities of being a human being on planet Earth. Right? Instead of contributing to the world, they can go back to their little virtual closet and they can disappear for hours, days, even weeks at a time. And I saw the Pokemon craze in that way. I thought, wow, this is fun. We had a great time. What if this was abused? What if in some way it gets us into trouble? As I was standing next to the parked car, I saw three of my family members walking across Main Street, head looking at the phone, waiting for Pokemon, and they stop in the middle of the street, I mean, almost on the white line, because a Pokemon had appeared, and they stood there trying to catch it while cars were coming up on them. And I had that thought, what happens when we are so distracted and disconnected that it puts us in problematic situations? And this was sort of what I had been thinking. So I go online, I go on social media, and I'd seen this meme, this gag that was posted by imnotrightinthehead.com. You know what? Let me read it to you verbatim to make sure that I get the gist. I'll just pull it up here real quick. I hadn't planned to read it, but let me look at it. It said, "For crying out loud, if you leave this building in order to catch a Pokemon, you will be terminated. I am ashamed for the entire human race for even having to write this note." So apparently we have an exasperated employer who is pissed off that his, you know, that his charges, the people he was paying to do work, were just leaving their cubicles or whatever, and they were going out to catch Pokemon on the clock. I understand that frustration. So it was a funny gag, all it was. So I posted online. And this is, of course, where the comment thread did what comment threads so often do. It becomes a forum for people to argue with each other. It's exasperating. It's exhausting. But it happens over and over. I'm amazed at just the useless, funny, benign crap that I put up just for a gag. And I come back in an hour and people are chewing each other to ribbons over this stuff. No matter what it is. On Pokemon, one person said the employer absolutely has the right to be pissed off. People need to do that shit on their own time. Well, a dissenter says, hang on just a second. Break time is your personal time. Lunch time is your personal time. The employer doesn't get to tell you what to do on your breaks and lunch, and somebody else comes in and laments the amount of personal information that the Pokemon app is extracting from your smartphone and how wrong that is. And then a dissenter for them says, wait a minute, you clicked I agree and gave permission. Besides, what do you think's happening with the information? You think you're being tracked by the government? And it just goes on and on and on. If I can digress, if I can take a little bunny trail for just a second, I have come to a point after how many years have I been doing this? I started the website in 2009, YouTube page, same year, radio show in 2010. That's 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 7 years of watching YouTube commenters tear each other to pieces. And I'm over it. In fact, it is for that reason that I will only normally check a YouTube comment section right after something posts to make sure there's nothing technically wrong with it, and then I move on. Because life is too short. If the users and viewers and listeners can get benefit from them, wonderful. But too often, for my taste, they're just marked by ugliness. Now, there's a brand of commenter on the internet. Certainly not all. I think some people who post a comment are reasonable and they genuinely have something to say. They want a further discussion and they want to perhaps challenge or agree or ask a question. They're using a comment section the way perhaps ideally it's supposed to be used. There's also another kind of commenter, and there's a whole culture of these people who seem to have nothing else to do in their lives but sit their asses down and just be ugly. Stir the shitstorm, dissent, say really nasty and insulting things to and about other people. They love the attention. You know, they're like the class clown. You're in high school, you're in a class of 30 people, there's somebody who's always going for the cheap gag, who's always disrupting, who's always trying to be the center of attention. Now, whether you laugh, or whether you're shocked, or whether you're pissed off, whatever your response is, they're getting a response. They are the focus for that moment, the focus of your attention. They're getting paid off for whatever antics they're doing. There's no such thing for them as negative attention. Those people are everywhere. The more disruption they make, the longer the argument thread goes on, the more powerful they feel. They're not making any significant difference in the real world outside of this tiny little microcosm that they've decided they're the king of, or at least an influential member of. No, they just go into the comments section, feel powerful because they got somebody else riled up about something. Or maybe they're just ugly people, and now they got a bullhorn called the internet, and they can amplify that ugliness so that hundreds, perhaps thousands of people can see it. It's so exhausting, it's so exasperating, it's so discouraging. There are people in my own movement. Now, those who say that all atheists are rationalists, or all atheists are kind and measured and reasonable and generous and are making the world a better place, those people who say that all atheists are anything have no idea what they're talking about. The first mistake was using the word all, because as the clever line says, all generalities are false. Everywhere you go, in atheism, in religion, in this culture, in that culture, in this group, in that group, you'll find the best and the worst and everybody in between. But I'll tell you, the worst make me weary. I was reminded of John Coffey's quote from The Green Mile. You ever see The Green Mile? It's based on a Stephen King book. John Coffey is this huge mountain of a man with a miraculous gift. It's a fanciful story, but it's actually a really good one. And he kept talking about how tired he was. You know, I'm dog tired. But mostly I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. That is exactly how I feel. I'm just tired of people being ugly. They have the opportunity to say something generous and kind, to disagree respectfully, to challenge passionately without being an asshole. And what do they decide to be? An asshole. It's exhausting. Anyway, I posted this Pokemon thing. It didn't get all that heated in that particular Pokemon thread. It wasn't too bad. But even in the comment section of this video, there will be someone who comes in and just stirs the shitstorm because they can, because it feeds them, they get attention. It allows them to amplify the pathetic personality that they brought to the table. Speaking of pathetic, did you see that guy on True News? Rick Wiles is his name. He's the host of True News, which produces these videos and content. It's religiously motivated, and much of it is very Alex Jones, kind of Hal Lindsey, the end of the world, everything's satanic. You know, the satanic panic is not over. And of course, Satan, according to Rick Wiles, is using Pokemon Go to spawn demonic powers and kill Christians. Here's an article posted in Right Wing Watch. By the way, that's tough to say. Right Wing Watch. Say it 5 times fast. I'll wait. RightWingWatch.org. It was written or submitted by Brian Tashman Wednesday, the 13th of July of this year. It says this. True News host Rick Wiles recounted a story about how he called the police after seeing a man taking photos of his office building, only to discover that the suspicious man was playing Pokemon Go on his phone. Wiles, however, said something sinister is afoot, warning that, quote, these Pokemon creatures are like virtual cyber demons, and that, quote, what this man Friday was trying to find was the Pokemon demon that had been placed inside the True News office. What if this technology is transferred to Islamic jihadists? And Islamic jihadists have an app that shows them where Christians are located geographically, he asked. Noting that many of the apps, is it pronounced Pokestop? Pokestops and gyms include churches and other houses of worship. Quote, the enemy Satan is targeting churches with virtual, digital, cyber demons. Here's just one soundbite.
If this technology was in the hands of the wrong people,
right,
and you designated all the churches, mm-hmm. and you could even take it so far as the homes of the pastors, the elders, the deacons, the Sunday school teachers,
right,
the youth pastors, you could have a phone with an app that would lead you to the physical locations of these strong Christian leaders.
And what we found was startling about where these Pokemon congregate.
Now, this guy's legit. At first, I thought it's Landover Baptist, which is a satire site that's always posting craziness like this. But Rick Wiles is at least presenting it with a straight face. Maybe he's just cashing in. Maybe he's one of those guys who's totally unscrupulous and he doesn't buy any of it, but he's manufactured this sort of end times persona to get donations from who knows what his motivation is. It's like Alex Jones. Does Alex Jones really believe the stuff that Alex Jones says, or is he laughing all the way to the bank? I think it's impossible really to know. We can't read his mind. We can't know. But I think this guy is genuinely believing it. He's at least positioning himself as someone who is warning a generation about the evils of Pokemon and demonic power. Now, things digressed even further when Rick Wiles' co-host, whose name is Edward Saul, S-Z-A-L-L, I hope I'm saying that right, read a fake quote from the creator of Pokemon. This has been debunked. There's actually a Snopes article about it. But the story goes like this. In a rare interview with Pokemon creator Satoshi Tajiri, he admits the games were created as a backlash against his Christian parents. He also said the games are tailored toward an anti-Christian sentiment or Satanism. And of course, this is completely crazy. It's false. It's debunked. It never happened. Doesn't stop these end time satanic panic types from latching onto it and proclaiming it as truth. Heaven forbid they fact check anything that they bring to the table and promote to their viewers and listeners. It did not happen. Pokemon is not a product of anti-Christian propaganda. Okay. But that's the narrative being sold out there. Ironically, a lot of churches are using Pokemon as a way to attract traffic. They're creating these little Pokestops at their churches in a way to get people to come and at least drive into their parking lots, if not enter their door and become introduced to the church. They're using Pokemon as a marketing tool. Religion News Service wrote this July the 11th, 2016. If your church is suddenly overtaken by millennials with their heads stuck in their phones, you can thank Pokemon. The Nintendo-owned franchise, which produced colorful cards and later video games, is back, this time luring young adults out of their apartments and into museums, parks, and places of worship. And then the article describes Pokemon Go and what it is and the fact that it's a viral sensation. And then the article continues. But as some gamers are discovering, virtual Pokemon can also be found at several churches, too. And it's not just churches. Synagogues are working themselves into the game, too. The Union for Reformed Judaism has created If Pokemon Were Jewish, imagining such characters as Jigglyburg, a cousin to Pokemon's Jigglypuff, who can chant from the Torah. The game's Pokestops and gyms, where players can gather in the real world to capture and battle their virtual Pokemon, are based on user-submitted locations. One of these gyms is at 701 Southwest 12th Street, Topeka, Kansas, the home of anti-gay Westboro Baptist Church. When a user named Love is Love took the gym over, it sparked a back-and-forth battle between LGBT Pokemon players and the hate group. Westboro posted a tweet on the 11th of July that said, "Everything, real or virtual, enables proud sin in America. That's a sign of doom." And it included a Pokemon Go hashtag. There is nothing new under the sun, is there? Every generation is wailing and moaning and freaking out about the influence of Satan on our culture. It was only a few decades ago they destroyed pinball machines because pinball was a tool of the devil to corrupt our youth. Elvis Presley records were burned because of those unholy gyrations of his lower extremities. Those were so carnal. It was almost like little demons had come to earth and were taking over his legs and dancing for him. Just terrible. Ozzy Osbourne, when I was growing up, it was Ozzy and Alice Cooper and Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath. They're of the devil. Harry Potter is of the devil. We did a whole broadcast called Harry Potter is of the Devil about the satanic panic and all the things that our parents freaked about that turned out to be nothing. And here we are in the year 2016, the era of the decoded human genome, and people are warning that Pokemon is infecting us with demons. As far as my family's concerned, will we play Pokemon Go again? I don't know, maybe. We had a good time, we had fun, and that's the point. People are always pointing fingers at other people, decrying what other people do to relax. Now, people who spend 5 hours on the golf course will mock people who spend 2 hours playing a video game. I've never understood this, right? It's fun, it engages you, it's what you do, it's what relaxes you, it's your hobby, your pastime. You know, Natalie likes to call it bubblegum for the brain. We live stressful lives, right? We're busy engaging in the real world, we have responsibilities. I think to a healthy degree in moderation, it's great to find some bubblegum for the brain. You know, the guy who's got his basement or office and he builds an elaborate model train, what has he accomplished? Well, he relaxed and enjoyed himself. You know, he had a good time engaging in something that gives him pleasure. That has merit. What about the people who play baseball or people who play frisbee golf? We started playing frisbee golf. We started on the Wii, of all things.
We Frisbee Golf has become an obsession. And then we segued to a real Frisbee Golf course, except I was informed by the purists that it's not Frisbee Golf, it's Disc Golf. Okay. I went out to the course expecting to throw a Frisbee. You know what they gave me? Wasn't a Frisbee. It was a disc. And there are several kinds of discs. There's a whole culture for disc golf I didn't know existed. They brought out this big thing, this big package, and you open it up and there's tons of different discs. It's like having a golf bag filled with golf clubs. And you have your drivers and then your mid-range disc. I don't know what you call those. I don't know if you call them irons. And you actually have a disc called the putter. Short-range disc called a putter. I said, no, I can't throw these. I'd like to throw a Frisbee. You can't throw a Frisbee. It's not Frisbee golf. We're playing disc golf. So I'm having to learn how to throw this thing, this saucer. I'm still crap at it, but I'm learning. And I'm having a good time learning something new, getting outside, making friends, distracting myself. In moderation, it is a wonderful thing. Find your bubble gum for the brain. Find something that feeds you, that resonates with you, that gives you joy, and do it. I guess that 30-minute monologue is plenty, don't you think? Let us finally, my friends, go to the switchboard, okay? Let's see, area code 315, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
Well, my name is Paul. I'm a high school English teacher. And as I was listening to you talk about how to generate positive conversations and just in terms of making a conversation where, I don't know, people can have dialogue while not getting entrenched in one side or the other and putting up defense barriers and just kind of frothing at the mouth. As I've been trying to kind of coach people on having, you know, really hard conversations, it's been instructive for myself. And one of the things that I've tried to begin to implement as I've been able to try to do my own conversations with different people is that, you know, I try to use, I guess, plural pronouns in a way. I try to use things like, I think that that's a really important piece of information. I think that, but I think we can take it one step further. And in when I'm having these dialogues, one of the things that when I start using the word we over and over and over again, it kind of makes the other person on the other side feel as if, you know, we're in this conversation together. And that we're trying to actively work towards some kind of solution. So I wanted to just, I guess, bring up the topic of trying to, in your opinion, how do you go about having dialogue with people without putting up those defense barriers to make someone feel like they're actively, you know, you're kind of like a, and we're in it together, trying to figure out what is true, that kind of a thing.
Well, it might be, we may be talking about two different things. I think I was, you know, bitching about the people who take joy in being agitators. You know, they're only happy when they're unhappy. Nathan on the chat said something I think that might be pretty close. He said, at least in game terms, folks are hyper-competitive. There seems to be no real consequences online for hostile speech. And there may be some truth to that. There's a, even when you use your real name instead of like some handle that you made up, there is a measure of anonymity. You know, you are sort of behind a mechanism. You're behind the console. You're behind the curtain. You feel a little more powerful. You might say or do things that you normally wouldn't do. The people who show up just to make things difficult because they can, I don't think there's much hope. But as far as using the pronouns, I think you're spot on. You know, it's like conflict resolution. When you're speaking to someone, if you say, I'm sorry, you don't understand. I'm sorry you feel that way. I'm sorry you just don't get it. It's not really an apology because the you in that statement is really a is sort of an accusation. You're too much of a dumbass to figure it out. And I'm sorry that I have to take valuable time to explain things to you, that kind of thing. I'm a fan of the word I, of using the word I in these sorts of conversations when we're trying to diffuse things. It's like, you know, if you have a conflict with a friend and you go and you say, you offended me. It's different than saying, I was offended. I was hurt. I felt betrayed. I felt like you didn't understand me. I like to use the word I. I think we probably serves the same function. Instead of using the word you, which is probably one of the the things that really gets people to double down. If we redirect and make it more about us or myself, you know, I wish you hadn't done that. I felt that it was wrong. By using those words instead of you, I think it helps to keep people from not feeling like they're being pushed back on their heels, that they're being attacked, and there might be a greater opportunity for dialogue. It doesn't always work, but I've had success with it.
Right. Yeah, no, and in my own experiences, I've seen that it doesn't always happen, but there are some people that will respond to that a little bit better because it makes them feel like, you know, you are included in that conversation, and that, you know, oftentimes I'll use phrases like, okay, you know, I think that I hear what you're saying, but I think that there's another detail that we can kind of consider. So why don't we consider this? And it, on the whole, usually I do get people to respond a little bit more positively towards me with that, and they tend to spew a little less acid, I guess you can say, towards my direction.
Have you noticed what I'm talking about, though, Paul? I mean, when you're online and somebody says something that's relatively innocuous, I mean, they're just talking. But especially in, you know, these months where political opinions seem to be flying back and forth like grenades and everybody's on high alert for whatever pet cause they brought to the table, it doesn't take much to get people to just go right off into orbit.
Yeah, I do definitely know what you mean. A lot of times they'll call it political frothing at the mouth. And actually, believe it or not, I think I used one of your phrases when I was teaching one of the days where I said, you know, the YouTube comment section is where political or where, what was it?
Where discourse goes to die. Yeah.
To die. Yes. I used that before and I liked it very much. I have seen that. And I've also felt the same frustrations as you do. And it seems to me that, yeah, they're the people who, you know, typically, from my understanding, human behavior happens for one of two reasons. Either you're trying to get attention for something or you're trying to avoid something else. And so for these people who are just, you know, posting a lot of these comments, when you hit really hard the all caps button and then just kind of go from there, you know, you're really trying to get a reaction.
Well, I appreciate you, my friend, Paul. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling the broadcast. It means a lot, my friend.
All right. Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. Take care of yourself. In the chat room, it said, did you hear Dogma debate this week with Robert Price? What are your thoughts? It was difficult for me to hear a loved atheist speaker act the way he did. I have no context, my friend. Didn't hear the show. I would suppose you're speaking about Dr. Price's affinity for, I think he may be a Trump supporter. Is that accurate? Bob has mentioned, I know, on his own radio show, and I think he mentioned it once on mine, that he is a political conservative, a proud conservative. Now, I don't follow his politics all that much, so I don't know how deep that particular rabbit hole goes. You know, on this issue, he and I politically would stand apart. But I may have to go back and find that Dogma debate broadcast and listen to what you're talking about to find out what was said and what his positions are or were. Now, this is where I can already see people mashing at their keyboards in the comment sections. And they're already living at the extreme ends of the pendulum swing. There's no room for nuance or complexity in any of the arguments that we're having. It must be A, B, 1-0, black, white, either, or. If I say that I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, I must be a huge fan of Hillary Clinton. So now the Clinton critics all come out in full force to challenge me and ask me, how could you? Well, I don't live in a binary world. I mean, unless I have to. You know, I mean, if they put two candidates on the ballot, I'm going to have to make a choice. I'm going to have to make the A-B choice, right? But I don't see them as black and white. I don't see them as ones and zeros. I see a hugely complex scenario, an overwhelmingly complex mechanism loaded with different gears going in different directions. There are things I admire about Hillary Clinton. There are things that make me crazy. I don't think she's remotely close to being the most qualified candidate for the highest office in the land. In fact, I don't think anybody who's run in the last century has been remotely close to the most qualified people for the highest office in the land. I honestly see political office quite often, it's the leftovers we get. The truly qualified people are either too radical or rogue to fit inside the system, or they said, screw this, and they went off to be successful in their private lives. They went where they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy and the slow as molasses decision-making processes and the red tape and the infighting and the waste and the insanity that has become government, they said, no, I don't think so. And they went off to be successful and be leaders and to instigate change in some other aspect of their lives. They didn't need it. They didn't need the grief. They just checked out. And we're stuck with the leftovers. Anyway, moving on. What else was I going to talk about? Oh, I know we have a lot of, I'm just babbling. I know we have a lot of Trekkies in the audience. Had a chance to go see the new Star Trek, Star Trek Beyond. Cynical about it. Not because, you know, I'm a purist, and I kind of am in some ways. Huge fan of the classic series. I'm one of those guys I have, in fact, I just downloaded on Audible. I've been running more lately. Kind of screwed up my elbow on the tennis court, so for cardio, I've been jogging 2 to 3 miles at a clip. I'm trying to get to a consistent 3 to 4 miles. And so I throw audiobooks in my ears to be able to pass the time, because running is god-awful boring. So I downloaded William Shatner's Star Trek Memories. I downloaded Star Trek Movie Memories, where he talks about the making of all the Star Trek films from Star Trek the Motion Picture through Generations, which was crap, by the way. Downloaded Stephen Fry reading Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's brilliant. It is so stinking good. I know I just finished it. I downloaded The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, which is narrated by Martin Freeman, which is, it's good, but it's not Stephen Fry good. I'm going to go back and listen to Hitchhiker again. I've read the damn thing 5 times. I'm going to go back and listen to the audiobook again. It's just fantastic. But anyway, I've been on a Trek thing, so we went to go see Star Trek Beyond. There will not be any spoilers. There will not be any spoilers whatsoever. Other than to say it's, you know, the reviewers are right when they talk about the fact that it's a lot like a blown-up episode of the TV series. You know, you're not going to change the world. You know, there's a good guy, there's a bad guy, there's a scenario involving danger, and they got to get out, and there's a shit ton of action in it. You know, it's really a fast-moving kind of thing. It's not one of the more introspective treks, but it didn't have to be. I was not a fan of Into Darkness. I did not like the way they tried to reimagine or reinvent or reboot the Khan thing. You cannot reboot Khan. You cannot reboot Khan, Noonien and Singh. You cannot reboot Khan. I don't know. I don't care how much I love Benedict Cumberbatch, who is awesome. He's brilliant. He's amazing. He is a near deity. He is not Khan. He's not Khan. Huge mistake. Screwed the whole movie up. So I was a cynic when Star Trek From Beyond came out. And went and we had an absolute ball. In fact, the audience in the theater was a packed house. They applauded when the credits came up. So, you know, it's a pretty good time. So anyway, it ain't Citizen Kane. But if you're looking for some Trek, you want to scratch that itch, they actually do, I think, a fine job. And I like Chris Pine and the sort of these reimagined classic characters. I like what they've done. I like the new Enterprise. I just feel like it's feels like Star Trek, unlike the trailer which just released for the Star Trek television series that's going to come out in 2017. They've got this teaser with some adequate CGI where they've got the new Star Trek ship Discovery and it's launching from a rail system inside an asteroid in the depths of deep, empty space. It makes no sense. It honestly looks like something that a 3D artist did on Lightwave or 3DS Max in his bedroom. It was not impressive. Is it Star Trek Discovery? Is that what it's called? All right. Because the ship is called Discovery. I'm going to withhold judgment. I'm not going to write it off until the series. I'm going to wait till and watch the series. But I was watching the teaser and I was thinking, you know, one should never see a teaser for Star Trek and say, eh. Let's see what else. What else was happening that was worth speaking about? Oh. We have Netflix, and they released like 26 episodes of Bob Ross, The Joy of Painting. You know who Bob Ross is? PBS. Big in the 80s and 90s, did like 400 episodes of a show where he stands against a black backdrop with a blank canvas, some like household paintbrushes, a 2-inch paintbrush that you might paint your trim with at the house. They're not even like fancy artist brushes. They're just household brushes. And in about 26 minutes, make something amazing. Every time he starts something new, I say, he screwed it up. And then I'm like, oh, that's nice. A happy little tree with a happy little mountain in the background. Happy little bird and a happy little sun. Makes a happy little cabin. I love how he does water. Now, I can't paint. I can't draw, right? Not in my skill set. I cannot do it. And he keeps telling me. Keeps telling me through the television. He died in, what, 97? But he's telling me through the television, he's like, you can do this, even if you've never painted before. You can do this. You can do this. You know, there are no accidents. Wait, there are no mistakes. They're only happy accidents. So we're talking about it in, I think, a couple of weeks. I think we're going to have a Bob Ross painting party at my house. We're going to go get some those cheap easels you get, you know, at the hobby store or wherever. We're going to get some canvases. We're going to buy some of those oil paints. He always used the same colors. You know, he uses yellow ochre, whatever ochre is, phthalo blue, titanium white, bright red, a couple of others. He uses the same, pretty much the same. We're going to get a bunch of those. And we're going to roll the show in real time. I think the rule is going to be you don't get to pause it. We're just going to roll. We're just going to try. And I think there's going to be five or six of us all there in the living room, and we're going to paint. We're going to Bob Ross paint in 26 minutes and try to emulate what he is doing. If I do it, I promise you, if I don't videotape the actual painting of it, I'll shoot a photograph and show everybody. I myself am curious. I can't paint. Bob says, oh, everybody can paint. Give yourself a chance. I can't paint. No, everybody can paint. It's, have you seen that auto-tuned thing on YouTube? I believe. Every day's a good day when you paint. That's Bob Ross in my head. So we're going to do it, I think, in a few weeks. And if I paint a Bob Ross, I'm putting that. I might even auction it off for charity or something. We'll see if we can raise some money for Doctors Without Borders or something. Oh, man, I'm just babbling. Area code 313, you're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Who's this?
Riley.
Hi, Riley. What's going on with you?
Hi. So at my school, I'm starting a secular alliance, and the teacher told me to come up with some bylaws and rules, and I really have no idea what to come up with.
You need the Secular Student Alliance itself. Are you doing this on your own, or are you already tied in with SSA?
I'm going to do it with them too. But my teacher wanted me to come up with them, and I'm waiting for the school year to start so I can ship it to the school.
Well, let me ask you this, Riley. What was the attitude and or response of the school when you suggested an SSA? Were they sort of weird and trepidatious, or were they like, go for it?
Yeah, kind of like go for it. I mean, we have a GSA. We have a very big Islamic population and Christian population where I live. So we have an Islamic club.
How's that go over? What state are you located in, Riley?
Michigan.
How's that going over in Michigan? I mean, are people weird about it? Are they cool with it?
Well, at least where I'm from, we're pretty used to it by now. Like, we have a huge Islamic population where I'm from. Like, we had the first mosque and stuff in my city, so it's pretty big.
Well, you know, there have been a great many people who've started SSAs or attempted to, or some form of secular group, and the students have just flipped out, you know. They've ripped the posters off the walls, and their parents have complained to the school. And, you know, I was just reading some articles the other day about one of those things about how difficult it is for secular people to be able to have these types of activities and groups. And certain parts of the country, certainly, especially in the South. In Michigan, yeah, I guess it would be a little looser up there. They get a little less freaked about that kind of thing. As far as the bylaws, unfortunately, I'm probably not going to be able to help you. The SSA, far more expert at this kind of thing. And if they can't hook you up or you can't reach anybody, you just drop me an email or send me a Facebook message and I'll hook you up directly, okay?
Yeah, I've been working with them. I just was asking for more ideas.
I can put that out on social media. We'll see if anybody's got some experience. You know, certainly we'll pool the resources of viewers and listeners and see if maybe there's something they've tried and that they know that we don't, and maybe they can help you, okay?
That'd be great. And I just want to say one more thing. I love your show, and I emailed you, and I could not believe you responded. Like, that was so cool.
Well, I try to respond whenever I can. You know, the inbox is insane. But I feel like if you've taken the time to send a message, the least I can do is my best to try to take the time to say something in return and to acknowledge that. And so hopefully I answered whatever question you had whenever you emailed and you got what you needed. So,
well, it was kind of a story. I told, when I was camping, I was listening to the ghost stories.
Oh, I remember this email.
Scary.
I remember this email. You were, and you know, that's the best compliment you can give me, right? I was terrified by your ghost story show is probably the best compliment you could give me. So we're going to try it again this October. We'll see how we do. Okay, Riley?
I can't wait.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for the kind words and thanks for calling. You take care, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. See you later.
Right, bye. Bye.
These people just make me happy. They're just so full of love and they just say such wonderful things. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's see. Some folks are trying to Skype in, but Skype is giving them trouble. Well, this is one of the reasons why I haven't been recently using the Blog Talk Radio switchboard, because the BTR switchboard has been glitchy, to say the least. Keep trying, okay? I've got 775. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's up?
Hey, Seth. It's Kat and Wes.
Hey, what's going on, you two?
Well, I've got a bit of a situation here in Reno. You see, lately the Christian door knockers have been coming around. And even though I have a sign up that says no solicitation, no religious solicitation, they're still knocking on my door. And the thing is, the text they start using is they're using these little kids, you know, between, I'd say, 5 and 10 years old to come and proselytize to me.
So if you kick the kid off your porch, then you're the asshole, right? You're damaging a young child who's just trying to help, kind of thing. Is that how they've set it up?
The last time they showed up, I looked the kid in the eye and I said, you know what? This book that you're here, that you're trying to push on me, ain't nothing but a crock of horse shit. And, oh my God, you'd think I was attacking a kid.
Now, wait a minute. Are the adults in the periphery watching this, or are the kids on their own?
Oh, yes. Yes. The adults are right there.
I mean, I understand why we would want to throw out, this is all a bunch of horse shit. But have you considered perhaps leading with questions? I mean, the kind of questions that will probably, I mean, it'll make them crazy, but perhaps for the child in a productive way. I mean, you think about this kid, if you say this is a bunch of horse shit, they go back to their little adult minions and they talk about the evil, misguided, sad, pathetic people who rejected God and live in misery. Look how angry they are. But if you've got the kid there and you got 90 seconds, I mean, you've taken the time to answer the door, you know, one option might be just to start throwing stuff at the kid in a kind way, but try to get the circuits to reveal how cross they are. Hey, do you believe in Noah's Ark? Yeah. Well, tell me how penguins walked 8,000 miles to board a boat in the desert of the Middle East. Can penguins live in the desert? And then just sit back and watch the kid, you know? Try a few of those and you'll probably see a short circuit go off. And it's possible that those seeds of doubt will grow into something down the way. They'll go back to their adults and say, he asked me about penguins in the desert. I didn't know what to say. Those types of things might even help carve a path where he or she can escape some of this indoctrination earlier than the rest of us did. I don't know. Just an option. Just an idea.
That's absolutely brilliant. I can't believe I didn't think of it at the time.
A lot of it is just I was learning from my own mistakes. When I first was having conversations in the first few years with people, I was leading with declarative statements. I had a pocket full of data. We don't know who wrote any of the books of the Bible. You know, there is no evidence for a literal Jesus as a savior. There is no this. There is the people can't live to be 500, 900 years old. People can't. It's impossible. It's scientifically proven that evolution is real, blah, blah, blah. I was leading with all the data. And when I started to have a little more success, and actually the conversations went on a little longer, is when I started saying, who wrote the book of Genesis? Can you tell me who wrote the book of Genesis? You know, who wrote the book of Exodus? Who wrote the Gospels that tell the story of Jesus? How does someone live to be 900 years old? How do donkeys talk? Have you ever heard of that? You know, how, why? Put the burden on them and make them work it out and defend it. It sort of keeps them, in many cases, off the defensive. They're obviously going to become frustrated, but it's more of an organic internal frustration rooted in the fact that they can't explain or defend what they're positing as fact. And then they have to go off and try to figure it out. And I think that can be a very productive discussion in many instances. So if you see a young mind up there in a kind and positive way, you might consider saying, hey, how and why? You know, can you explain? Can you teach me and tell me this and that? Because it doesn't make sense to me, but I'd like to know how it might make sense and watch the kid's mind start to turn, okay?
All righty. That made a lot of sense.
Well, I appreciate you both, and I know you both have good hearts and good senses of humor. And I understand your frustration. They've accosted you in your castle. You got a sign on the door that said, don't bother me. You're right. I've had a long day. This is my safe spot. This is where I chill. This is where I hang with my loved ones. Stop ringing my doorbell. I understand why you're pissed off. I'd be pissed off, too.
Well, you know, it also doesn't help that they come to the door and knock like law enforcement, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You're not getting sleep.
And the whole room shakes when people knock on the door like that. And so that already got me on the defensive.
I think if you have a no soliciting sign up, depending on the state you're in, it may be a breach of law. It may be illegal for them to, maybe they don't consider it solicitation because they're asking you to come to their church or dropping off a tract, which is a free gift instead of selling something. Maybe that's the difference. We'll see what the legal experts in the audience have to sort of offer up on this one. I'll be curious. You guys take care of each other, and thanks so much for listening and for being a part of the show. Great to hear from you.
All right. Have a great one, Seth.
Bye, Seth.
Take care. Good night. They are long, for those who are newer listeners, they are long-time listeners. I think they were calling the show from my very first year, I think, back in 2010, 2011. We called Wes the Shaman. I don't know if he's still a shaman, but he was a literal shaman, and it became this story that we would continue to tell. And so from time to time, he and Kat would call the broadcast and give me an update, and they were always sort of, you know, going at each other. It was always an enjoyable thing to hear from them, and it is again. Back to the switchboard, area code 307. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
Hi, my name is Casey, and I'm calling from Wyoming.
What's going on, Casey?
Not much. I just got off work and I saw that you were having a show and I thought, great, I'm going to call in.
Well, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I was curious, and excuse me if this has been asked before on the show, but what are your thoughts on a Donald Trump administration?
You hear that silence?
Yes, I do.
There was a telling article in... Was it in the New Yorker? Let me look it up here.
Was it that one by the ghostwriter who wrote Donald Trump's book?
Yeah. Let me look that up. The article was published July 25th. Donald Trump's ghostwriter tells all about a guy named Tony Schwartz, who essentially ghost-authored Trump's huge mega best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, back in the 80s, when Trump, I think, was not even 40 years old, something like that. And he had been previously a journalist, and I guess he took a lot of heat, rightfully so, for lumping himself in with Trump and taking the money, cashing the check. And, you know, he saw it as an opportunity and he took it. And here he is in the year 2016, and he was so terrified by the idea of Trump winning that he came forward and said, look, you need to know what I saw behind the scenes. And he did this sort of expose of a guy who has a zero attention span, who really knows nothing about the world, who doesn't really read anything. He only reads the sound bites, the headlines, and skips past. He's extremely unscrupulous. He doesn't really care if it's a lie. For him, it might be true in the moment. Someone who will easily steamroll over other people to get what he wants, who will make up a narrative about all the wonderful things that he did or did not accomplish. I mean, he'll just embellish the hell out of it. Much of this is not uncommon in politics, but, you know, Trump is running on many fronts as the outsider. The billionaire is supposed to represent the common man. We're all laughing under our breath. But this is the narrative that I'm hearing many people embrace. You know, he's not afraid. He's not beholden. He's an outsider. He's a rogue. He's going to go in and shake things up and fix everything. And I think, you got to be kidding me. You know, this is a man.
A lot of people are attracted to his charisma.
Well, this speaks to something else. I mean, we are living in a time where many people are hugely fearful. I mean, I don't know if you saw, I couldn't watch the speech. I actually read the transcript of Donald Trump's speech at the Republican National Convention. And, you know, the pundits were right. It was a fear-based speech. Everything's terrible. Everything's scary. The world is on the razor's edge. It's a good thing I'm here to fix everything. Right? He comes off big and brash and bold and strong and charismatic. And there's a certain segment, a certain demographic of the United States population that responds to that. They're making an emotional connection to someone who pats them on the head and says, I'm strong and I'm tough and I'm smart and I'm successful and I'm here. They respond to that. If you reveal to them what the biographer had actually said about him in the article, in fact, let me read just a couple of paragraphs. I think you'll find this fascinating. Tony Schwartz, the ghostwriter, had known what Trump was like all this time, but he only came forward recently, according to him, because he didn't think Trump had a shot. Like, he didn't think there was any way he would ever secure the nomination. But holy shit, there he is, the Republican nominee for president. And as things had come to critical mass, Schwartz decided to go public with this interview in The New Yorker to expose and reveal the Trump that he has seen behind the scenes. Quote, I feel a deep sense of remorse that I contributed to presenting Trump in a way that brought him wider attention and made him more appealing than he is. I genuinely believe that if Trump wins and gets the nuclear codes, there's an excellent possibility it will lead to the end of civilization. Now, I sense a little hyperbole going on here, but let's move on. All right. If he were writing The Art of the Deal today, the article says, Schwartz says it would be a very different book with a very different title. Ask what he would call it, he answered, The Sociopath. It's impossible to keep him focused on any topic other than his own self-aggrandizement for more than a few minutes. And even then, Schwartz trailed off, shaking his head in amazement. He regards Trump's inability to concentrate as alarming in a presidential candidate. Quote, if he had to be briefed on a crisis in the Situation Room, it's impossible to imagine him paying attention over a long period of time. Schwartz believes that Trump's short attention span has left him with, quote, a stunning level of superficial knowledge and plain ignorance. That's why he so prefers TV as his first news source. Information comes in easily digestible sound bites. I seriously doubt that Trump has ever read a book straight through in his adult life. Schwartz also said of Trump, quote, he lied strategically. He had a complete lack of conscience about it. Since most people are constrained by the truth, Trump's indifference to it gave him a strange advantage. When challenged about the facts, Schwartz says Trump would often double down, repeat himself, and grow belligerent. Finally, in his journal, Schwartz wrote, Trump stands for many of the things I abhor. His willingness to run over people, the gaudy, tacky, gigantic obsessions, the absolute lack of interest in anything beyond power and money. I created a character far more winning than Trump actually is. Schwartz is apparently so embarrassed about the fact that he was involved with the book that he's decided in 2016, starting this year, to donate the royalties from all book sales that he gets to charity. I find that interesting. Anyway, coming back to my original point, which I started eons ago, but I will finally here come back to. If you bring these challenges, you know, if you bring the reality of a manufactured Trump facade to light, if you talk about the flaws, the bankruptcies, the bad decisions, the stories that are now coming to light by people who've done business with Donald Trump and been horribly treated, if you see and hear the quotations out of Trump's mouth about so many things that are just ugly and untoward and certainly not something you would ever want said by a potential commander-in-chief. If you bring this to light, I've found most of his followers don't even care. It doesn't make any difference. It's almost like you're dealing with a religious person pointing out the flaws in Scripture because they've fallen in love with the idea of Donald Trump. I did a speech last year called The Mother of Bad Ideas, where we talk about the emotional connection that people have. This airbrushed, glossy, idealized version of whatever, be it Donald Trump or Jesus or Mother Teresa or whoever. People fall in love with the idea. They become infatuated with the idea anyway, and then the facts don't matter anymore. It doesn't make any difference. Now, is it anything new that people feel a connection to a candidate pandering to their emotions? Absolutely not. But the shallowness of Trump, in my opinion, is what makes his particular scenario the most alarming.
I'm just nervous about the prospect of Donald Trump being in the same room as Vladimir Putin.
Any world leader, right? Any world leader.
Because everything in politics is about compromise, and he's not one for compromise. So, what makes me particularly nervous is that he said this week, I believe, that he doesn't want to follow Article 20 of NATO, which I think is very telling about him as a world leader or as a prospective world leader, that he won't abide by international agreements, which I think is absolutely insane.
Yeah, and that plays right into, this is the best damn country in the history of history, and I don't care about the rest of the world. I don't care what they do. I don't care what they think. It doesn't make any difference. America, right? Not realizing that while we are citizens of the United States of America, we are also citizens of the world. What we do, what we don't do affects everyone, just as what they do affects us. Well, again, if you insist on coloring issues relating to world affairs, foreign policy, Putin, radical Islam, you know, immigration, how to grow the economy, build business, how to do this, how to do that. But you're only drawing these things in red, white, and blue crayon. You're not going to really get anything done. And that insular environment, that insular attitude is actually going to make you dangerous on the world stage. Anyway, I guess all we can do is just sound the alarm and cast our vote and participate as best we can in the process, my friend. And for your first day to the voting booth, I wish you the best. And we'll just see what happens, all right?
Yeah, all right. I'll see you.
I appreciate the call, my friend. Thanks so much.
Yep.
Area code 215. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
Hey, it's Julie from Boston.
Talk to me, Julie. What's going on with you?
Well, you know, just when I think I've seen it all in conspiracy theories, like I was listening to your conspiracy theory podcast a couple weeks ago, you know, just hanging around Boston the other day, and I was talking to this guy, and I just could not believe this guy. We got into the subject where I said something to the effect of that, like, it seems to be the attitude in the United States is that sex is just something you got away with rather than just something that happens. And he said, well, that's because the government controls. They're trying to lower the population. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, UN article, I forget what it was. And I did go to their website. It did say something about maintaining a sustainable population. But then he says, well, they want to reduce it to 500 million, and they're doing it by implementing sex ed so that people won't want to have sex and won't want to have kids. And then like he starts saying, the drug companies, the things that are antidepressants actually make people suicidal. And they're also encouraging abortion and to try to reduce the population. And I said, well, where are you getting this from? Where is your evidence? And then, he just pulls out like this you know, stack of papers that he printed off the internet. And I said, okay, was this peer reviewed? Was this, and he said, oh, it was. And I said, was it published in any journal? And then, you know, he goes on about, well, if they did that, you know, the government would come after them. And then he said, how many children do your parents have? And I said, two. And he said, why? And I said, because that's what they could afford. And he says, okay, how many kids do you and your brother have? And I said, neither of us has any kids. And he says, why? And I said, well, for one thing, I don't want kids. For another, I can't afford them. I can't speak for my brother, but he's not even married. And then he says, well, that's because the government brainwashed you into not wanting to have kids. And he said, you think they were born that way? And I said, I don't know. How is that relevant? And he said, well, wanting to have kids is natural, and anything that's not natural is the government trying to brainwash you in order to reduce the population. And what I find when I deal with these people, it's like, you know, I wish I had the debating expertise of like someone like Matt Dillahunty, who just always has an off-the-cuff response that just pushes the guy into the corner. But what ended up happening, you know, it's like playing chess with a pigeon. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. Well, it sounds to me like this person's been long lost in tinfoil hat territory anyway. I mean, no real discussion is going to be had. Mostly, I think you just sit back and watch the fireworks, right? You just watch the crazy. You know what I'm saying?
How do you argue with people like that? Because they sound not, I mean, if we're not for the, for like the content, it really would sound like it was well-researched. And if you don't have an instant retort, you know, they think they won. You know, it's like a pigeon shitting all over a chessboard when you're playing chess with a pigeon. It's like, what do you say to these people? What would you say?
Well, I think some of this speaks to the style over substance aspect of some debates. And this isn't always the case, but I grow frustrated at, you know, anybody can throw out a quote unquote source and it might look impressive on its surface and it can be overwhelming for the people who do it really, really well. You know, they jump into a Gish Gallop of some kind and they're throwing data points at you. But there's a difference between throwing a source, quote unquote source, at me and throwing a source at me that we can take time to digest, a source that's been peer reviewed, data and information that's been examined by experts in the field and re-examined and tested and retested, that lives permanently, exists permanently under the white hot light of scrutiny, that's improved every single day, that's whittled at and changed when necessary. That's a different kind of information than much of the conspiracy related stuff that we see thrown out in these types of exchanges. I myself don't do a lot of debates. In fact, I really don't do debate at all because I don't enjoy it. I'm not great at it. You know, debate is a very specific skill. Matt Dillahunty is a great debater. Christopher Hitchens was a great debater. There are many great debaters out there. They thrive in the format and they do very, very well. Now, that's a debate in a formal capacity. As far as everyday people in casual conversations, exchanges with people who believe specific things, yeah, I engage people all the time and they engage me. We have debates. I myself don't spend a lot of time on the tinfoil hat crowd. From my perspective, and I could be wrong, they exist so far out on the fringe that they have then become a waste of time. You know, they have embraced a conspiracy mentality and they will not let go. I have better things to do. And many people might disagree with me. Many people might say, well, you should engage. You should counter bad information with good information. Even in these extreme scenarios, it's not a waste of time. Many people might disagree with my perspective, and they might be right. But for my part, you know, if I see the tinfoil hat, I move on to other things, you know.
Yeah, I just like to work on my debating skills because I just look at Matt Dillahunty on the Atheist Experience with such admiration. I mean, all those people that are on the show, but him especially, where people call in with most time-wasting stuff and he just knows how to respond.
I think we need good debaters out there, but you know, if I were you, I would watch many of the great debaters, learn from them quietly in the wings before you jump into the fray, okay?
Right.
Hey, thanks so much for the call. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast. Greatly appreciate it, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. That would have been a wild conversation. I don't spend a whole lot of time on the Illuminati types. You know, the moon landing conspiracy types, the chemtrail types. That's just a whole other level. That's something different. You know, I don't know. I just see it as tinfoil hat stuff is just the only thing I can really say or think about it. Thanks for listening to this show tonight. Talk about random. It was just kind of whatever sticks to the wall, and that's just fine with me. I hope it was okay with you. I've got David McAfee on the podcast schedule. He's going to join me next week. I've got an audio and a video of our conversation as we talk about a new book that he's got called The Book of Gods. It's a book that's a resource for children, and it's actually something I considered pretty awesome. We're going to talk to David about that. It's coming up next week. In the meantime, have a wonderful week, and I'll catch you later. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.